Okay, so, and actually this is now specific to you. So Alan says, in Abel's back specialization phase, which of the exercises helped with improving the most? So I assume improving
good question.
Back development the most.
Yeah. So I would be fairly confident in saying that it was these diagonal pulls and the isolated lower back work and the combo of the two, because it's actually quite easy because those are the ones. So diagonal pulls I've never done prior to that, whereas chin-ups roughly at like shoulder width or a bit narrower, wide grip pull-ups and pull-downs of all kinds, lat prayers, I think not with the right technique, but still I have done those for forever. And the other one is, well, I guess also a diagonal pull, but rows in a more kind of narrow plane, which I'm actually kind of starting to think that if you do a row like very diagonally versus like you do a vertical pull, like not so diagonally, it more or less like gets you to the same place. Like if I tap my lats, like kind of like get stretched equally with both. So I think that really just doing movements that really put the lats under a good stretch, which when that finally clicked, how that feels, that was a sensation that I just never had before. And I was like in the camp of like, oof, like what a deep stretch that I'm feeling, but it's not really the lats. Like it was just like my upper traps, like being shrugged up to my ears, like scapular elevator muscles and like all of these things. So I think to me that was a big change. Now I do think I have a very stubborn back, because I legit see people in the gym who have been lifting for 6 months and have like comparable backs to mine after like 10 years. And then the lower back work, definitely. So I do think that was underdeveloped, and I think it's visible how much that improved. Like now, if I look at myself in a mirror with another mirror, then I actually do see some like thickness to my back, which earlier I had some width, but it was just this kind of scrawny, underwhelming look. So I think that those two, and of course, like I did more volume, but I would attribute it to those two lifts.
Are you still doing those?
I am. I'm trying to be a bit more like time efficient now with my workouts. So I try to do bilateral, like use both of my hands at the same time if I can, and not do too many unilateral stuff, because it's just annoying. And I also switched gyms because I was also sick of like the same gym for like 6 years or seven now slowly. So, and on that one, like there's not a very good place to do diagonal like one arm pulls, but I still do back extensions for the lower back. I still do RDLs and good mornings. I do a lot of good mornings in the Smith machine actually, which I really surprisingly good actually. And yeah,
that
those two.
So I've always hated good mornings. I don't think I've ever incorporated them more than a month. But in the Smith machine, it almost seems so. You are essentially just pushing your glutes back, right? Since you can't bend forward.
Yep. So basically, what I do is I stand. So if the bar is here, then I will stand back, basically as much as I can, while I can like obviously still duck under and like put it over my traps, the bar. Now I will unlock it, and then I will just push my butt back normally as I would on a free weight good morning. And so like basically at the end, like it will almost be this diagonal angle, like my thighs will be actually like not straight anymore, but almost like not a 45 degree angle, but like I don't know, 70 degree angle. I think I'm not missing out on that much this way. Now in my case, I do it a lot more so for my lower back than for glutes and hams. So I think I would be standing maybe a bit closer to the bar. But I expected it to. So I think like deadlifts would not work as well, probably. I mean, I tried it like logistically, it's just almost impossible to set it up. But I don't know. And the reason I like it more than Romanian deadlifts at this point is because I can just use so much less weight. Like, I don't like to load up all the 300 kilos on the bar with the deadlift. Just kidding.
Right.
No, it's not that much. But like, yeah, like 150 kilos even, like that is like seriously crushing you afterwards. Like, good mornings, I can still work out after that.
Yeah, I always find it amazing how variable any sort of hip hinging movements can be depending on form. I mean, obviously every exercise depends on form a lot, but I remember when I was in high school and like early high school, and I was doing hyperextensions with a 85 pound dumbbell, I want to say. And I remember seeing the owner of the gym, like jacked guy, very clearly enhanced, just doing it with 45 pound plate. And just being so confused by that, right? And I'm sure it was very easy for him. But then you and I and Brian were talking about how I added them back in. This was maybe a couple months ago. And the difference between if I just picked up the weight, you know, I just get a 100-pound dumbbell and just pick it up, and how easy that could be compared to if I just took a 45-pound plate and held it and positioned it in a certain way and slowly went down, held the pause, and went back up. I mean, even just a slow 10 reps was grueling. And I mean, got to the point that was it muscular failure or was it just incredibly uncomfortable? Kind of hard to say, but just how much more difficult it can be made to be. And that is where I have a hard time with the progression of things. You know, I've said in the past, one of the, I don't want to say nice things about looser form, but if there's a level of form that you are allowing yourself to be comfortable with, of that, you know, again, maybe a little bit loose, then every time you do that lift, it's almost easier to gauge the progression versus sometimes when you're so strict, you can make such a lightweight feel like it's to failure. And then just these little bits of just getting back to quote unquote normal form allows you a 20 or 30% increase in performance where it wasn't really an increase. You just went from almost overly strict form to normal form. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think we talked about it, but like if you become like very, very mind muscle connection focused and you do these slower reps, like I think you become so like tuned in with every sensation that you have in the muscles that you almost induce a failure point earlier. So obviously like slower reps are harder, but also like I do notice it that when I'm like, okay, and like now my bicep is contracting and like, ooh, like, and I'm pausing, like it basically like by the time fatigue, like seriously start kicking in, I was already like so dialed into every bit of discomfort or burning or whatever was happening in the muscle that real fatigue then hits like a hammer and it's like, oh, wow, that's it. Whereas like, if I was like a bit more performance focused, then it would be like, okay, it's heavy now. How can I overcome that? Like it would be just like set up mentally completely differently. So I think that can have like a bit of an inherent performance, like compromising effect. So I don't like this. Well, if you're on the juice, then anything works. Like, I don't like that sort of thing that a lot of people preach on YouTube, but I will say that like, maybe if that jacked guy wasn't enhanced, then the 45 plate wouldn't have done it for him.
Yeah. And that's always a fine balance. I just saw Alex Leonidas had a collab with Mike Isertel and Jared Feather. And I liked the video. I thought it was a good video. It was kind of cool to see them meet up. But they went through exercises that Alex was comfortable with. So bench press and dips and all this. And they talked about the emphasis on these muscle groups, and they kind of made a much, much lighter weight feel heavy for him. And I think the idea was, hey, you know, here's this guy who was doing all these like powerlifting movements and he was really strong. But if you do it like a bodybuilder, then it's really going to emphasize the muscle. And it's like, well, that's great. And of course, anybody could take those lifts and make them much harder by emphasizing certain things and whatnot. But that doesn't just inherently prove to me that if he were then to do that, he would gain new muscle. And that now that he's got this bodybuilding focus, I mean, yeah. You still ultimately, and I'm sure, like Mike, I know 100% thinks progressive overload is important and focuses on progression over time. And I think one of the things is you have to say, okay, you can talk about how it's just about progression, but how do you get there? And it could be absolutely that by focusing on the muscle and the mind muscle connection and the stretch and all of that, that the muscle then will progress faster. Like, that's great. I don't disagree with that. I'm more just saying that just because you can take an exercise and make it so hard doesn't mean that that's now inherently better for hypertrophy. And obviously Alex has gotten a great level of development with what he's been doing. I think there might be some examples where a new exercise is helpful. Like he had mentioned himself that on stage, despite very heavy deadlifts, his hamstrings were kind of lacking, but he had never really done leg curls or anything like that. So, okay, you were actually missing exercises. And that's where I think exercise selection is very important. But again, I just think you can overemphasize the form a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that completely.
Cool. So this actually kind of ties in with that a little bit. So he said, do you guys track your lifts these days? So I assume, so you're tracking your performance on the lifts.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't do it as much as I should. But I will do it again now. In fact, I already started doing it more diligently, but I did go through a long phase where it was, so it was getting to the point where like making further strength gains was difficult already in a surplus. And then when I was cutting, and then like the cut was already going on for like 2 months plus, then, you know, on the same lifts, it was just really, it was just not going to happen. And honestly, that's the worst. Like when it, when basically lifting with these exercises, just like completely, you lose purpose with it. Like you either do it to just get a good pump or something, or to burn calories, but like there is nothing that you're trying to accomplish because there is nothing that you can accomplish. I mean, in some cases, I literally maxed out a lot of the machines in the gym. Like these are not super great advanced bodybuilding design machines, but like, it was so purposeless that there was just no point. So I would just open up my tracker and I would just like pull up the exercise. It automatically shows my performance from the last session, and I would just like click save and then update for three sets, and it would just log the three sets with, I didn't even look at the number because I knew that it will be what it was last session or something around that, but like there will be no PR because like it literally maxed out, and like, but it's still heavy enough that I won't go from 10 reps to 11 or something, because 10 is already like crazy. I don't even get that on most sessions. So it was honestly, like it really gradually just decreased my motivation for training. And that's actually one of the reasons I switched gyms. Like at least like here, there are new machines and like, okay, like there is this rowing machine. Like it will be a while until I max this one out, if ever. So like now I'm tracking it more, and I would recommend really to anyone, like if you ever catch yourself in a position where your training sessions have just no purpose behind it, then do so, like then fake that purpose with something, pick new exercises or something. But I do think that tracking is important, just like taking measurements is and everything.
Yeah, I think tracking is very important. I think, I mean, nobody here is going to be surprised to know that I keep records of everything. And I just think it is so common for people to actually believe that they're making progress when they're not. And they say, oh, this mesocycle is going so well, or this lift is going so well. It's like, well, have you even done this lift before? Or are you just making new progress? Or is it actually stronger? I mean, even I've had myself numerous times where it could be pictures, you know, there's a lot of flaws with pictures, but I'll think, oh, wow, I don't know if I've ever really looked like this in a picture before. And then I'll go back 2 or 3 years. I'm like, oh yeah, I actually kind of did look like that. Or I think this was the best I've ever hit this lift. And I look back, actually, I was like pretty close to that. And so it kind of humbles you, but it's also, I think, important to be able to actually gauge what is happening and even push yourself further. So I think it's very easy to just say, okay, this was hard, but when you know you have to beat what you did last time, you just turn up that gear a little more, right? You can just go to a new gear. And I think that for most people, that is almost necessary to push as hard as you can, right? If somebody says, okay, you just have to get one more there, versus, oh, I got to go till it's hard. Like I've mentioned before, I enjoy training when I go on vacations and whatnot. I'm almost sure that even though it feels like I'm training hard, I'm probably not hitting the same level as intensity because I'm at a new gym, new exercises. I'm kind of having fun versus I'm really trying to beat what I did before, which does, again, going back to what I said before, make it kind of mentally draining, right? Like there is this kind of, you know, when you go to a new exercise or I reset form, I enjoy it more because I'm like, okay, there's less on me to have to beat this. But I think that mentality of having to beat it is often helpful for somebody to learn how to progress over time.
Yeah. Yeah. Like just maybe, I guess I took it for granted that like people listen to what I'm saying in context of being an advanced lifter and like this being something I can even come to an acceptance with at times that I'm just not progressing because I have been training for 10 years now, I think. But yeah, like for most people, like it's really, that is the number one thing that's, they should not skip around their training, like outside of the gym, besides eating, of course. So like, yeah, like not tracking for beginners and intermediates is definitely like just a surefire way of ending up wheel spinning a lot of the times.
Yeah. This is interesting. Underrated or unusual things. And sorry, I should say the name here. Valenquar lifts. Underrated or unusual things you found to be beneficial toward your bodybuilding goals.
That is an interesting one. Do you have any thoughts like right away?
Or? Right off the top of my head. Yeah. I think that's a really great question. I think it kind of needs like a little bit of thought, right?
That's a good video answer, topic.
Yeah, yeah. Good question here. I think so. Just again, this is just some things that come to mind off the top of my head. I think if somebody is really new, then getting a food scale could be really helpful nutritionally. So this is less like bodybuilding helpful for muscle growth, but more of just a gen pop. I think a lot of people are really unfamiliar with portion control and portion sizes and whatnot. And I think if somebody thinks, okay, so I'm going to have, I want to follow the If It Fits Your Macros approach. And so I can actually have a little bit of ice cream, and then they measure like a serving size, half a cup of ice cream. It's like, oh, this is like 4 bites, right? Or peanut butter is a big one, right? Like, oh, a tablespoon of peanut butter doesn't actually mean you're filling up a whole spoonful of peanut butter, things like that. So this is kind of like a silly one, but I think probably a lot of us take for granted at this point that we can measure or estimate portion sizes so well. So something like that, I think, would help nutritionally. I have mentioned before, I really liked the tape measure in terms of another tool to help people gauge progress. And I don't know if this would be more overarching, but I would say ways to gauge progress objectively can be very helpful for people. If you can set it up in a way that it can give them more buy-in. So one of the hardest things with clients is to get them to say, okay, I understand. I mean, I have a number of clients who know what to do, and it's just hard to get them to be consistent with it, at least beyond, again, like the basics. And if I can get them kind of wrapped into the idea of I am progressing each time, there's just like a human desire for progression for most people, right? You kind of get that dopamine rush when you're doing better. And so if you can get somebody to say, okay, this is beating this, whether that is a tape measure, whether that's a scale, whether that's in the gym, I think that is not emphasized enough. You see a lot of stuff in the fitness industry that's, oh, how do I have this good workout or this burn? And I think if you could get people kind of almost hooked on the idea of that incremental progress, that would be very helpful. And definitely what was responsible for a lot of my progress.
Yeah. Actually, I could think of two or maybe three. Two of them are underrated. So I actually, or overrated. I think warming up is a bit overrated. So now if I had to like advise someone now, I would definitely say, yeah, warm up. Don't just go into things cold. And I don't go into things cold, but my warm-ups are actually very, very minimal. And like they have been getting even more minimalistic as time has progressed. So like, I mean, honestly, often like before something like
a low incline Smith machine bench press, I will do like one warm up set. So I will do something like, yeah. So I mean,
is that
I will, like,
after you've already done other exercises?
Not always. I think the other day, actually, that was my first lift, and I would just climb under the bar, set up the, like, the proper positioning of the bench so that, like, the bar, like, as descends to the right point of my sternum, and that I will do like just a few reps to try it out. But I wouldn't really consider that as a warm up set. And then I will, like, let's say I will, I think I did 95 kilos. That was my working weight. So I did a set with like 60 kilos, I think, like one or two reps.
Okay.
And then I think I went to 95. Like, maybe I did like a single rep first with that, and then rested like 30 seconds or something just to get like used to how that feels. Before like Romanian deadlifts and things like that, I will warm up more for sure. And before squats, but actually the squats, like Smith machine squats, and I go like really deep. Honestly, I often, like, I will barely warm up before those as well. I will just like maybe go down like once or twice to just see if I have the depth. But if I do, I will just jump into it. And
what time do you work out?
I work out like 3-4 p.m.
Okay. I'm just thinking because I work out in the morning, and I'll get up, it's maybe 6 a.m. and I'll start by 7 a.m. and I'll be doing some pull-ups, and I will do 4 warm-up sets typically before I will do my first work set. Same thing, like leg curls. Like, there's just no way I'm going into a deep stretch leg curl first thing in the morning when I wake up. And then with like the pull-ups, there's just no way I'm getting this like big stretch in my lats and then hoisting up 50 to 100 pounds without numerous warm-up sets.
That is a big caveat indeed. So I think that in the morning I would need more warming up for sure. I would probably even do some like treadmill, like moderate pace walking, at least to get my body temperature up a bit. For sure. And then actually another thing is, so I think that tracking down all three macros separately, I think that's overrated. It's fine to do, and I'm sure there are some benefits, like consistency is just so good, nutrition, like in terms of, or when it comes to nutrition in all fronts, like when you eat your meals, how much you're eating, like all of, like the more consistent you are, the better. So I'm sure there are some benefits, but I think like the, like people put such a high emphasis on it that like you ask someone in their off season, like comfortable like 20% body fat, and then like, yep, I'm eating this many fat, this many carbs, this much growth protein, and it's like, dude, like, why do you know that? Like, you shouldn't know that. I mean, not that you shouldn't know, but it would drive me crazy to track all those numbers. And one thing that's underrated, I think, is just liking your gym. I've been in a couple of gyms this past year that I just like really hated the people there, hated the vibe that I was getting. Just it was such a drag. Like in Hungary, one time I was going to a gym where like I had to sit in the car for an extra like 15 minutes to get myself to go in there. Because like it was such a horrible vibe.
That. Yeah.
I kind of like recall telling you that. Yeah, and like so if you like the, you like the people there, like in this current gym, the machines are not that amazing and whatever that I'm using, like kind of like old equipment and whatever. The people are nice. Like, you feel good going in there.
Yeah.
And it just makes such a big difference.
Yeah, I like your take on this question. I think going in, there's probably a lot more that we could easily say is overrated, right? Then I could just kind of immediately think is underrated. I do think that the macros, like knowing the exact macros for most people, just totally not necessary. I do not track. I mean, I guess I do track my macros in the sense that I put them in the app, but I don't care where my fat and carbs lie. I mean, within reason, obviously, but for almost everybody, caloric intake, adequate protein intake, that is really going to be sufficient for the vast majority of people. I think there's a lot of workout details that people overemphasize and all of that. So that's a great point. And then, yeah, I think the gym environment for consistency is important. I don't think you obviously have to love the gym for the results to work, but to your point, you're not going to want to go there. This is one of my reasons lately for wanting a home gym is the gym environment of where I go. it just kind of sucks compared to other gyms that I've been at. And I just find myself, I just don't want to go. Like if I imagine doing the same thing, but I'm just at my house or, you know, at a gym I used to go to with friends, totally different vibe. And so I'm not the type of person who's going to allow that to stop me from working out, but I'm sure a lot of people could, where they just say, hey, I just don't want to go there. You know, or maybe if you're a woman and you get creeped on at a certain gym, like that's going to just kill your vibe. If every time you go there, you've got all these guys interrupting you and talking to you, like whatever it is for you.
Yeah.
I'm sure the vibe could be, you know, a big factor.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, why don't you like your current gym? Like, are the people like eyeballing or what are they doing?
It's not really anybody specifically. I just found that, you know, I realized most of my life had been going to university gyms. So like in high school, I actually worked out in my basement. I got a really good setup off of Craigslist back then. College gym, met a lot of my close friends there. Dental school, a lot of close friends there. And I just knew people. I also worked there throughout school. So again, I got to meet a lot of people. And then after that, I just found that because in that environment, almost everybody's doing what you're doing, right? So you're all kind of generally young, ambitious people doing a lot of similar things in life. And then I found when I was just going to general gyms, I would try to like talk to some people and I would find some interesting people. But a lot of people sometimes people would come up to me and then they would be kind of rude about something, you know, like not wanting to work in or vice versa. It was just like not as good of an environment. And again, that's broad strokes here. Plenty of fine people, but I know, like, if I think of some of my closest friends in my life, I've met them at the various gyms I've gone to. And lately I just find that that is not, at least at this gym, my experience. Just people doing very different things with their lives and whatnot. Just harder to relate to certain people. And that's where I think like it's great with the podcast, because I think when I talk to you and Brian and 3DMJ guys and all of that, we can have very relatable conversations. And a lot of the people at the gym are just like, okay, this is clearly not somebody who I'm just going to be keeping up with, other than like a friendly, like, hey, you know. And also, I've seen a number of patients at my gym now. I mean, probably, I don't know, less than a dozen, but still like quite a number of patients. So some people will come up and talk to me there, and it's just kind of harder to focus, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing. Like these people that like, so you kind of know them from the gym at this point, but you don't really know them. Like you don't really have anything to talk about, but like there's this obligatory small talk in the beginning. And like, you know, those people where like even the small talk just never wants to happen. Like your heart sinks when you see them. Cause like, oh man, like people will be so awkward again. Like end the conversation and everything. So I have some of that as well.
Yeah. Right. Right. All right. So Vahanen says, or asks, thoughts on Clomid as an alternative for injectable testosterone for somebody with low both test and LH.
I think that's yours.
Okay. So, so for people who don't know what Clomid is, clomiphene, that is a SERM. So a selective estrogen receptor modulator. Basically the idea is that by blocking the estrogen receptors, you are going to then result in an increase in basically overall testosterone production, right? So your body's going to think, hey, estrogen is really low, and it's going to ramp up testosterone production as a function of that. So this is actually, it's funny that he mentioned that, because I just heard Peter Attia and Derek from More Plates, More Dates kind of talk poorly on this guy, Maximus Tribe. And I was like, why does that sound familiar? And I look back, and this guy he follows me, and he follows Derek, and he follows Tia, and he has created this Maximus Tribe thing it basically looks like he's just prescribing Clomid to people. And, you know, they're promoting it like, oh, it's a simple thing, and this way you don't have to inject testosterone and you're not shutting down your testicles and all of that. And Aptia has talked about why he does not like Clomid for this purpose. If you want to check out one of his podcasts, I think actually just listening to the podcast that he and Derek did would be good. But essentially, he found that it resulted in increased production of something in the cholesterol pathway, desmosterol, that he thought, or not thought, but that he had seen correlate with other issues. And so he ultimately decided that he did not want to prescribe it anymore. There's another isomer of clomiphene, N-clomiphene. So there's zuclomiphene and N-clomiphene. And in theory, N-clomiphene is supposed to have a better side effect profile, and who knows, you know, what's going to happen there. But ultimately, I would similarly agree with Derek and Peter that I don't agree with what this guy is doing and just prescribing Clomid to people as if that's going to be an answer. There's effectively no research on long-term Clomid intake on men. So you have some longer-term research on testosterone in men. You have some longer-term research on Clomid in women. But for the most part, there's just really not a lot of research on men. So to just say, okay, well, we're just going to prescribe it. I'll add one more thing here. So if you're taking testosterone, you're shutting down both your LH and FSH production at the pituitary, as well as your testosterone production and generally sperm production at the testicles, right? So you've got the Leydig cells that are stimulated mostly by LH and the Sertoli cells mostly stimulated by FSH in the testicles. So if you're taking testosterone, you're suppressing all of that. If you're taking HCG, that is basically going to function like LH. And so that is going to stimulate the Leydig cells. So you're still going to get testosterone production, but you're going to be shutting down the pituitary. So this person in the Q&A here is asking about Clomid for somebody with both low test and low LH. I'm definitely not saying that there would be no reason somebody might want to take Clomid. However, I would obviously say see an endocrinologist or a urologist first to discuss if this is even something you need. And are you also having symptoms of low testosterone? We talked about this before as well. You know, Brian Borstein mentioned his testosterone's in the 300s. I've seen many very impressive individuals with testosterone in the 300s. It's something that is mostly going to be based on symptoms. Just because you get a test that your total testosterone, especially if you're not even looking at free testosterone, you're just looking at your total testosterone being low, that might be like, if your body is not sensing that you need more of it, that could be why LH is low, because you don't need more of it. So you're not needing to produce more. So it's a little bit of a complex question, but I just as a general answer, I'm not a fan of somebody just taking Clomid long-term like that. And I would definitely discuss with your doctor, of course, if that's something that you want to do.
Well said.
All right. So this is a follower who I know has said that he looks up to me as a mentor and a leader in the industry. He goes by the name of
Bald just kidding.
Omni Man. No, I'm just kidding. So, but he did ask the question. So thank you, sir. So Paris asked, each of your current favorite and least favorite exercises. I'll let you go on this one.
Ooh, okay. Least favorite, that has to be the same for everybody listening. Bulgarian split squat.
Yeah.
and any kind of one leg, like lower body lift. With the exceptions of one leg extensions, which I do kind of like. Mm-hmm. I mean, like it more than the bilateral one. I don't like it, but if I had to pick, I don't particularly like most bicep movements. I actually don't like arm movements in general. It's just not really what it's. I wouldn't say it hurts my elbows, but it's extremely difficult for me to set up anything in a way that it just feels perfect. Like something is always like, oh man, it's like my elbow flexor, like tendons here, like in my elbow crease or the back of the elbow, or I guess like the elbow joint, like something is always, or something like a bit of forearm or hands. Like I always feel something a little bit at least. And by the way, the same thing with squat patterns. Like I will always feel my knees somewhat, like it won't necessarily like actually hurt it, but like I will feel something. But yeah, definitely like one-legged squat variants. Arm work in general is not my most beloved thing. Other than that, I don't have like really like big standouts that I particularly dislike. Hip thrusts, bilateral hip thrusts, That one does suck ass. I don't know. It's just like so uncomfortable, like everything about it, like the bar pressing on your hip bone and just setting yourself up in like to begin with. Most liked exercises like those would have to be like horizontal presses of all kinds. Like, I don't know, it just it feels so like quite the opposite of the arm training. It just feels exactly how it's supposed to feel. Mm-hmm. Like I do feel the pec like being stretched, and then like after that, like even if I train with low reps and don't do any like peak contraction, like fly type movements, I still get a good chest pump. And I have a pretty okay, like my chest might be my best like upper body muscle.
Yeah.
And like here, if I train in my little home setup and I do some chest movement and then take the shirt off, or it was off already, and I look in the mirror, it's like, damn, like right there, like good chest pump. So immediate reinforcement that like this thing worked, what you just did.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that would be most liked for me.
Nice. Yeah. So overall, I would probably have to agree with you. I think Bulgarian split squats might be my least favorite exercise of all time. Although I mentioned also, I hate good mornings, because at least Bulgarian split squats do feel like I feel that really burned, you know, where I'm trying to make it work. Yeah. Although I also dislike them. Not only do they suck to do, but they're also hard to gauge progression, because how much does that back foot, you know, play into the actual lift? And then the front foot, where are you placing it? It's very hard to standardize it week to week. Good mornings, I think, are easier to standardize, but I just hate the lift. I don't feel it where I'm supposed to feel it. So yeah, I would say both of those are in the running for my least favorite. As far as my, but I guess if we're saying current though, currently, I mean, I try not to do exercises that I hate too much, but I need to find a good tricep replacement, because I was getting to the point, like I said, I was doing like the overhead, and it was just like your shoulders are burning so much and going back and forth. There's no actual rest. So now that I'm getting a home gym set up, I got to figure out something for that. Favorite exercise currently, I'm really liking the incline chest supported dumbbell rows, and I'm liking close grip push-ups that I do at the end of the workout. And I think both of those speak to, they are exercises that feel good, like you're kind of locked into this position and the movement just feels nice and smooth. It's like a very even like a similar movement, right? I mean, in reality, like you're either pulling this way or you're pushing this way, but just that movement feels good. And then also the progression has been good. And I, going back to the psychology and the progressive overload aspect of this endeavor, it feels good to make progress at something. And I actually, as we were talking, I'm looking up here. So I added close grip pushups to the end of my workout when I started to go on this bulk. And so I want to do a little bit more volume. And I started on May 9th. And I made a post about this, how it's amazing how much progress you can make without necessarily gaining a ton of muscle, because you're getting used to it. And keep in mind, I already start my workout with a decline weighted pushup. And so for reference, my decline weighted pushup has gone from, so I was doing 63 pounds on my back for 15, 8, 7. This is a very slow rep done, and like different cadence and the kind of a higher decline. And I'm now matching those reps with 10 pounds added to like the bag I wear on my back. So good progression, added 10 pounds, and I've gained some weight. Conversely, the close grip pushup, again, this is a rest pause, has gone from 23, 13, 10 to now in 5 months, has gone from 23, 13, 10 to 38, 27, 23. Same position in the workout and all that, has gone from 46 reps to 88 reps. So huge, huge difference, even though I was already doing a push-up variation. Now, again, I've gained muscle. My arms are bigger, but it just really does emphasize that a new lift, even if it's similar to what you were doing before, can really progress a lot when it's new. But because of that progress, I mean, I've literally progressed every single dime I've done that exercise for the last 5 months. I've really been enjoying it. So that's been a fun one.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess those diagonal pulls I also could have mentioned. Like a good, especially like these rows, like, I don't know. It's also like you can pull some really impressive. Yeah, actually, like both of them, like a good like diagonal pull and like more vertically and more horizontally. It's also like very ego friendly, like because it's so stretch dominant, you're much, much stronger on, and because you're doing it with one arm. So, and if let's say it's like a plate loaded machine where like both arms are working independently, and then you're doing a one arm pull, like you will be putting on so many plates that will just not make sense to people around you. Yeah. So you're getting a good exercise. It feels good. It works the thing that you need to be working, good progression potential. And then you're getting all these looks from like these guys that are thinking that they're all tough, but they're like looking how much weight you have on there. It's a priceless feeling.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for this Q&A. We actually have another podcast, I think, coming up soon, right? With you and Brian. We've got a couple of good roundtables coming up. So a little teaser here. We got Brian and Abel. We got Eric Helms coming up soon. And then a special guest with Eric that people, if you want to guess who will be coming on with Eric, you can do that.
The wife. Just kidding.
So, but for now, where can we... Well, actually, I was going to say, where can we find more of you, Abel? But this will be probably part two on your channel, right? So,
oh, yeah.
We can say it anyway. Where can we find you, Abel?
Abel can be found on, SSD Abel on YouTube. And I have a website, ssdable.com, and an Instagram, Abel Fit Stuff. And that's it. What about you, Dave? Where can we find you?
BrainsAndGainsPodcast.com, Brains and Gains YouTube channel, and Dave_McConey on Instagram.
Sounds good.